My name is Danny. I'm an alcoholic.
Danny.
Kenny paid me $40 to say nice things about him. If you paid me $40, I'd say nice things about you. I met Kenny about 3 years ago, roughly, in a point in my life where I was very broken spiritually, mentally, and physically. And Kenny helped patch me up and threw me back to the wolves. No, Kenny's a really great guy. I'm really lucky to have him in my life. He's my sponsor. He's kind of become an uncle to my kid. We're from the same town. And Kenny's the kind of guy that I call when I need to vent, and he tells me everything I need to hear, even when it's everything I don't want to hear. He always sticks up for my wife and never sticks up for me. And I'm pretty sure he's going to do the same for my kid. So I'm one of the few people that get to feel really privileged that he's a part of my life, and I'm really grateful for it. So with that, I give you Kenny.
That was sweet. Give him about 3 or 4 days. He's going to be like, I'm never calling that ass again. So I'm an alcoholic. My name's Kenny. And, you know, the only thing we can do up here is it's just like what the book says, you know, in a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's what I'm going to do. So I was born in South Florida, Hialeah. I don't speak Spanish. I grew up there. I got 3 sisters. I'm the middle boy. I'm second oldest. And my parents stayed together until my father died in 1995. As a young boy, I, like a lot of young boys, I idolized my father. My father was great. He was the greatest thing since sliced bread, right? And I remember as a young boy going, why wasn't I named James? I wanted to be Junior. And my mother literally at one point talked to me and said, do you want us to change your name? And I was like, no. So I used to go everywhere with my dad. Both my parents worked for Bell South. My mom was an operator. My father was a lineman. And the linemen would meet at the yard and drink and go to bars and go play softball games. And I was like their little mascot. You know, I hung out with my dad, and he took me to bars, and he took me to softball games, and, like, his buddies would be like, go do that, and I'd go do it, and it was just great, and it was great fun, and I was one of the boys. My father started taking me out hunting, and him and his buddies would, at night, start drinking, and they would pass out in the back of pickup truck tail beds, because that's where we slept, and I would go around and mimic them. I'm like 4 or 5 years old, but I would mimic their drinking. Just take a sip of their beer because they'd leave it out. Take a sip of the bottle because they'd leave it out. And because I wanted to be like my dad, right? So me and my father, we ran around. This went on for a few years. And this is critical. I didn't always share this, but this is a critical point of my alcoholism, I found out. I was about 8 years old. My father was having an affair with this woman. And he was running me around, and I knew her, and everything was fine. Because I was raised up in, you take care of the girls, you take care of the family. What you do outside the family, not no problem. But you take care of your sisters and your mother, right? So one morning, my father decided to take my sisters to breakfast with this woman. And it wasn't that I was jealous that my sisters were spending time with me and my father and this woman. It's that at a very young age, I knew fundamentally this was wrong. It was okay for me and him, because we were the men. But now you brought my sisters involved. Now my sister shouldn't be here. So I went home that day, and I proceeded to tell my mother. And as you can imagine, it was a shitstorm. And at that day, I remember my father saying something to the point of, I forget exactly what was said, but basically we didn't talk for about 3 years. And, you know, I'm 8 years old. You know, I am a pissed off 8 year old that has experimented with alcohol. And mom's got a bottle of dry gin underneath the kitchen sink. And I started hitting this Gilby's dry gin. And man, it's what I needed. It's what I wanted. You know, that dry, limey taste running down the back of your throat, and then you get that warm, fuzzy feeling, and, you know, and that went on. You know, I would take it to school, hide it under my portables. I was extremely angry, like I said. So I fought any kind of authority. If you told me no, I said yes. If you told me it was up, I said it was down. I was on a first name basis with all the secretaries in elementary school because every day I was in the principal's office. I got into fights. I did what any rebellious, pissed off person would do. And I was a victim. And I could not see that then or for a while after. About fifth grade, they said to my parents that, we really think maybe you should take your son and put him in a private school because we don't want to expel a fifth grader. So could you just switch him to schools? So they did that, and they put me in this private school, and that was great because this private school sent a van. And all you had to do was stick your hand out the door and go like that and wave them on, and they just kept driving. So I didn't go to school for months until my parents found out. And I would stay home, and I would drink, and I would eat pizza, and nobody knew. I mean, my parents were a train wreck. They were like, I come from a very violent household, and there was a lot of violence, and there was a lot of dysfunction, and my parents were just, they were a hot mess. They were a dumpster fire. They did not have the ability to, like, really clue in on what the hell was going on other than trying not to kill each other and somewhat keeping their marriage together at that point. So I was well on my own. That went on into middle school, and I was drinking, and I started hanging out with the kids across the street who were all brothers, and I started experimenting with drugs, and I loved it, but I always loved drinking. That was the thing that made me feel warm and fuzzy. You know, I remember about 11 years old, my mother decided she was going to quit drinking gin, and she bought vodka, and I hate vodka, and I was so pissed. I was like, what the fuck is this, man? Like, this sucks. So that started me to go out and buy alcohol and find somebody older than me, you know, because I did not want to drink vodka. And that went on for a little bit, and I don't know, I was probably around 10 or 11. I bought I scraped up 10 bucks and bought a dime bag of pot. And back then, a dime bag was two fingers across the Ziploc baggie. And I bought it from my friend's older brothers. So here I am now with the older kids, and we're smoking pot in the park playing Frisbee. And I didn't invite my friends. They got upset, and they beat me up. Well, when you're like 10 or 11, you're high as shit, and you just got beaten up by your friends, you know. You go home crying, what's wrong? Next thing you know, there's a bag of pot out, and next thing you know, the cops are called, and I was ostracized from the neighborhood, man. Nobody wanted to talk to me. Nobody wanted anything to do with me. So I started hanging out with these kids down the street. You know, my life was a wreck. I was angry, pissed off. I mean, it was just hell. And these kids down the street, they didn't drink or do drugs. They went to church. They had a pretty sister. And I started hanging out with them, and I started going to church, and I started praying with the preacher. I would tell him what was going on in the house. You know, my dad beat the shit out of my mother. My dad beat the shit out of me. You know, I'd tell him all these things, and we'd pray. We would pray and on the steps of the church, and, you know, I'm just a kid, and I'm praying my little heart out. And nothing changed. So I don't think I ever really stopped drinking, but I slowed down drinking during this period. And nothing changed. I became Baptist. I became baptized Southern Baptist because I thought I needed a stronger God. I mean, I was Methodist, so, you know, maybe that God wasn't good enough. So Southern Baptist, we get a strong God in here and he'll fix this shit. Turns out, no. No, we didn't. So once I stopped going to church, and I started drinking again, I was pretty sure that if there was a God, he was doing this shit. And that was the deal. You know, he let this shit happen, and if there's a God, F him, because he does not care about me. So about 13 years old, drinking, partying, not going to school, man, just fighting with anything and everything, doing ridiculous things. Me and my sister stealing the car, doing just dumb, crazy shit. Me and my father, he hurt his back and retired from Bell South and bought a business, and he started making fully automatic weapons in our garage. And he started working for a guy that turned out to be the biggest, one of the biggest heroin and cocaine dealers in the southeastern United States. And we would make MAC-10s and Uzis with suppressors and 22s with silencers. And that was kind of our bonding experience again. Like, this is kind of what we did. I thought it was cool as hell. And this is how we started talking again. And this is how we began a relationship again. Still drinking, still fighting with them at every turn. That went on for years. My father ended up going, doing about a year and a half of minimum fed up here in Atlanta, over all that. So my drinking, I isolated to the point to where about 16 or 17, I really had one friend. Just one friend left, and he would invite me to parties, and people would be like, why are you bringing this guy? I was loud, obnoxious, I was nobody you wanted at a party. It wasn't fun to be around, you know. And I always wound up passed out drunk on the toilet, you know. I mean, I would start drinking and somehow always passed out drunk on the toilet, you know. I remember being 12 or 13, 14, and my sister's beating on the bathroom door saying, Mom, he's sleeping on the toilet again. And they were trying to get ready for school, you know. And there I was, just vomit everywhere, sleeping on the commode. Same way with parties. If you wanted to find me, just follow a trail of puke. You'll find me passed out on a commode somewhere. And so they would say to my buddy Andy, you know, like, why do you even invite this guy? What the hell? And he'd be like, he's my friend. And he was my one real friend. So I started working at my parents' nightclub and doing parking lot security. And I'd go in there and drink a little bit. And it was a bottle club. It was a private bottle club. And I would drive from South Miami to Broward, where I lived. And at this time, life is really just becoming unbearable. I mean, thoughts of suicide are entering my mind, you know. And I always glamorized it. I always wanted to be like, young man saves baby on I-95 and dies. And then everybody would know, you know what I mean? I would drive down the Palmetto Expressway in my pickup truck looking at 18-wheelers and being right next to the trailer going, thinking to myself, just one sharp right under the wheels, and it's over. And then thinking about the people behind them and all that, and I just couldn't do it. So this keeps up until I'm 18 years old. And my buddy Andy gets in trouble, and he has to go to treatment. He stole a car from Tennessee, his stepmother's or something, and drove down to Miami, and he went to treatment, and Andy shows up on this Kawasaki 454 LTD. Andy was a good-looking kid, always did well, socially acceptable. I was none of those things. And he's telling me about these meetings. And I'm like, huh. And he shows me a picture of his girlfriend. And he's like, yeah, there's more girls there like that. I'm like, maybe I should go. but Andy never said, let's go. You know, he'd just be like, all right, if you want to, let me know. You know, so I get this, I was hanging out with this girl that could drink as much as me. We would go out on Friday and Saturday nights or Sunday nights, and it'd be like two cases apiece in a bottle. And this girl could keep up with me, and I thought she was the love of my life. One night we were at a stoplight, and I stopped short, and I was in this little Datsun pickup truck, and she caught my beer and kept it from spilling. I was just like, I love you. You saved my beer. We're meant to be together. So I get this open container charge in Medley. I was definitely DUI, but it was before it got crazy like that. And I just pulled off the expressway. I had to pee. And Medley is a town near Hialeah, and it's got a bunch of containers. And I just was going to pull off and go pee real quick. But the cops pulled me over, and they gave me this open container charge. And me and this girl were in different cells, but it was, like, next to each other because it's a small town. And after that, she never spoke to me again. Shocking. But 2 months later, I was in my parents' nightclub, and it was just a regular night. And the bartender was there, and I started drinking out, just drinking Royal Crown and Coke. I was just going to have a couple of drinks. I remember I had a dermatology appointment in the morning. Somehow Royal Crown and Coke turned into shots of B-52s. That was in Royal Crown and Coke. That was about 8:30 at night. At about 5 in the morning, I was stumbling out going, oh, I'm leaving now. And he begged me to stay and sleep in the nightclub. And I was like, no, I got this. I'm fine. So I woke up to, hey, asshole, pull over. And I was south or northbound in a southbound lane on 441 at Hollywood Boulevard in State Road 7, 441. And I remember they said, got sick. I said, no. They said, what's on your shirt? I said, stain. And then they asked me, you know where you are? And I was smart enough. I looked up. I saw the cross signs, and it said, Hollywood Boulevard and State Road 7. And my mouth said, for anybody that's from Florida, Hollywood Boulevard and State Road 84. And those roads run parallel. Yeah. So I couldn't been there. So they took me to jail, and I had about $5,000 on me from the night's receipts. I got out of jail. I got bailed out about noon the next day. It was hot. I was hungover. But nobody was there to pick me up. So I got pissed off. So I took that $5,000 and I went out on the streets, and first person I met fell in love with me. First dude I met, he became my best friend, and we partied like rock stars. And it came the time a few days later to where I had to go back home. And when I tell you that me and my father had a very violent relationship, I mean, it escalated to where we were just pulling guns on each other and machetes. And it was extremely violent. So here I was. I was like, all right, this is it. We're about to get it on. This is going to be a Mike Tyson fight because I just pissed away $5,000 and he's going to be pissed. And we went in the backyard and he didn't say a word. He just had this look on his face. And I looked into his eyes, and I knew at that moment, none of my behavior, none of my actions make any sense in light of. I've always justified, well, you would do this too if this happened to you, and you would do this too. None of it. I realized that I created every last thing, that this was all my fault, that, like, this was on me. I had a serious fucking problem. And what was I going to do? So I forget how that interaction ended, but it wasn't with violence, which was amazing. And I called my buddy Andy, and he answered the phone, and I just said, what do I do? That's what I said, not hello. What do I do? And he told me to go down to this hospital and gave me the address and the phone number. I did. And I met with this person, and I just told the person that I just want to be okay, and I'm not okay, and I'm thinking about dying. And it was dog snot tears I met with this guy. He was like, well, let's get you into treatment right now. And I said, I can't. I got to go home. I got to talk to my parents, and I promised my father I would do something in 3 days, and I have to do it. And the guy was like, no, 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 you're not going to do it. And I'm like, no, I'll be back Friday. I'm going to make this work. Now, understand, left to my own devices, I do not have money for a 28-day treatment center, okay? I do not have insurance. I have none of this crap. So I went home and I sat my parents down on the couch and said, all right, we need to talk. I need to go to a 28-day treatment center. I'm fucked up. I got problems. My mother cried and said, no, no, no. My father said, and this is pivotal, he said, you're just a kid going through a phase. You'll grow out of it. I said, you guys need to send me to treatment. So off to treatment I went. 18 years old, I did 28 days in Humana, South Broward. And they did one of the greatest things ever. They sent me to meetings. They gave me a big book and they sent me to meetings. You know, and I followed my buddy Andy around. I wanted to fight every guy. I was too afraid to talk to any girls. I just followed my buddy Andy around. I remember the last day I was checking out of treatment, there was this little 5-foot-nothing nurse that went to Al-Anon. I was like, I'm scared to leave. If I leave, I'm going to drink. I don't know what I'm going to do. And she proceeded to tell me to drive down Hollandale Beach Boulevard to A1A, make a left in the second hotel, pull into. And she said, there's a young people's convention there. Go there. And I did exactly that, and I found my buddy Andy. Hallelujah. So we went to meetings, man, and that's what we did. And, you know, I mean, I'm 18 years old. I'm trying not to drink. I'm trying not to use. Back then in 1986, we weren't as forgiving in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, back then you, in South Florida, you raise your hand to share in a meeting. You don't just blurt out. So if you show up there and you're 18, 19, and you're just a train wreck and you really don't got nothing to say, they don't call on you. And then somebody next to you, if you keep putting up your hand, and this happened to me, will grab you by the hand and put it down and say, son, you got nothing to say. Just sit there and listen. And, of course, I was a very sensitive young man, so I did not want any part of that. So, and I went to the other fellowship a lot, you know, and it's because there was a lot of younger people and younger girls. And when you're 18 and you're in the program, there's only two things you want to do, chase girls and not pick up a drink or a drug, right? So that's what we did. There was maybe a half a dozen of us that were around my age. And we could tell you where each other were any time of the day or night. You know, we didn't need beepers or payphones or cell phones. We just hung out and we went to meetings. And I'd love to tell you that I'd never picked up another drink or a drug, but that'd be a lie. The next 4 years of being in the fellowship and trying to work this program and trying to implement these things, I had some serious obstacles. I could stop for a while, 6 months, 9 months, a year and a half one time. My relapses were never more than a few days, you know, just never more, because the consequences were right there. The consequences were always right there. There was no lag time for me. But I just couldn't get it. I couldn't get what you guys talked about, you know, and I'd ask, I'd say, like, you know, like, you know, how you get sober? How you doing this? And people be like, you know what? I found a power greater than myself. I got God. You know, I worked the steps. I got the spiritual principles into my life. And I knew you guys had lived life like me. I could tell by your stories. You know, I knew it was true, but I also knew that you were living life a different way. And as crazy as it sounds, I did not know how to do it. I came to the meetings. I listened. I heard all the quick little phrases that we throw out. You know, easy does it, but do it. You know, I couldn't. I didn't have it. I didn't have it. And looking back, I realized that I knew I was powerless over alcohol and drugs. I knew that when I did alcohol and drugs, my life was unmanageable. But I was pretty sure that I got the rest of this, because that God guy who abandoned me as a kid, fuck him. Pure and simple. I'd lie to your face and tell you, oh, yeah. I'd rubber stamp it and be like, you know, out of desperation, yeah. But did I really, really believe? I wasn't willing, you know. So being around this program for about 4 years, different lengths of sobriety, coming in, coming out, still struggling. Life sucks. April of 1990, I picked up a white chip. I stayed sober again for about 7 or 8 months, but something amazing happened this time. I hit one of those points again, and I sat down with my gun, a 38, and my big book, and I opened How It Works. And I started reading How It Works. And I started twirling the cylinder of my gun and taking the bullets out. And I read that line where it says, constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. I was like, holy crap, this guy wrote me an out, and I'm just now seeing it. This is my out. I need to kill myself. I need to die. This shit's not going to get better for me. It may work for you guys, but it's not working for me. And I've been around here for 4 years, so you can't tell me different. Thank God I'm a chicken shit. And I called my mother. And somewhere before calling my mother, I remember reading the 12 steps. And I'd gone through the steps before. You know, I'm not saying that like I didn't write a 4-step. I did. I'd gone through it. But it was more of an academic exercise. And I did not have 3 in my life. At all, you know. So I remember saying to myself, I'm going to work the 12 steps all the way through this time, and then I'm going to find a solution. And that and then I'm going to find a solution is, and then I'm going to blow my brains out. It was not like I'm going to work the 12 steps all the way through and I'm going to be, no. That's not what I expected. So I called my mother. I said, hey, come get the gun. I'm going to do something stupid. I went to a meeting that night, and it was Young, Sober, and Free off of Old Cutler Road in South Miami, where I was living at the time. And there was a guy there, and he was doing a big book study, and he talked about being passed out in his own vomit in a three-piece suit in front of Cutler Ridge Mall on a Sunday morning, coming to with a family walking around him. And I was like, this motherfucker knows. And hasn't anybody ever told him we don't say that stuff in public? You know? So after the meeting, I asked this man to be my sponsor. And he said some things to me nobody had ever said before. He was not loving, kind, and tolerant, and not open to it. He said, yeah, you got a big book. He showed me how to read the book, and I had been reading it wrong for all these years. Then he told me, he said, we're not buddies, we're not pals, we're not friends. Do not call me every day. Only call me when you got a question about this book. He says, we are not going to meetings together. I got a family, I got businesses, I'm a busy man. That guy could not shake me to save his life. I called him 3 times a day. He also told me something nobody had ever said to me before. He said, tell me what you believe, Kenny, not what you think I want to hear. There's no wrong answers in AA. So me and Jack, we started talking. We were reading the book, and, you know, we started arguing about these principles. We started arguing. Yeah, I knew I couldn't drink and do drugs, but, you know, this second step, had a power greater than myself. The third step, turn my will. So we're arguing over basically the third step, this part of the book. And he's getting pissed off at me. We're in his tire store in his office. And he looks at me and he says, Kenny, can you live life happy drinking and using drugs? I said, no. He said, well, you're fucked there, huh? I said, yeah. He said, can you live life happy not drinking? And not using drugs. I said, no. He said, well, you're fucked there, huh? And I'm looking at him like, what's your point? Because I'm not that bright. And he looks at me and he says, Kenny, basically you're fucked unless you get these spiritual principles into your life. He didn't tell me to get God. He didn't tell me to get Jesus Christ. He didn't tell me to shave my head and go down to Miami International Airport and become a Hare Krishna. You know, he told me that I needed to get these spiritual principles into my life. And I thought I was pretty slick, so I asked him, I said, well, all right, Jack, you're so smart. How do you do God's will? And he said, you do what's in front of you, and you do that next right thing. In a moment of honesty, I asked him, what if I don't know what the next right thing is? And he said, well, Kenny, you know what the next wrong thing is? I'm like, yeah. He said, don't do that. And before, I looked at, like, this whole God's will thing and God, and it was this very narrow, thin line I had to walk. You know, that like I had to be perfect. I had to be loving and caring and all these. And I found out that it was the exact opposite. I found out it was this broad road that it was not narrow at all. So we proceeded to follow through with the rest of the 164 pages of the book. And I got a couple of different sponsors along the way. I remember I did my fifth step with Mac, and when I was doing that, we were talking about shit that happened, and Mac was great. God puts people in my life when I need them. Mac was great because I'd be like, well, this happened to me as a child, and that happened to me, and Mac looks at me and goes, Kenny, I was given up at birth to an orphanage. And it was just like, bam, well, you beat me there. And then something else goes on, and I was like, well, how about this? And he's just like, bam, and he beat me there. You know, and I don't remember a lot of it. I remember he walked me out of his house and said, we'll meet again next week and we'll finish up. And I met him next week, and some things had started to change in my life. The way people were treating me, the way people reacted to me. And he told me that, he asked me, he goes, you remember walking around my house last week? And I was like, no. And he was like, yeah, I thought you were going to throw a television out my window. You walked around my house like 30 times, Kenny. And I was like, I didn't remember it at all. I emotionally blacked it out when we were talking about this shit. And so there was definitely some deep-seated shit, and I did not get out. And that's paramount with the whole you're a kid going through a phase thing. So I stay sober for almost 5 years. My dad dies 1994 Thanksgiving week. And set it up a little bit more. About a week beforehand, me and my father were having a conversation in his home, and he asked me for a ride somewhere and yada yada, and I told him, I don't have time for you and your shit, and walked out the house. And like the next week, he dropped dead of a heart attack. So I am exhibiting not the most spiritual of behavior. I am chasing women in Alcoholics Anonymous with no concern with their well-being. I am getting patted on the back by all these older people because I can quote the book and I can say beautiful things in meetings and I just sound so good, and they're telling me how, look at you, you're just such a young little member of AA. You got so much ahead of you. You know, you're just such a good little member of AA. And I soaked that shit up. I soaked it up. People, thank you for sharing. I loved what you said. Yeah, I'm fucking great. You know, till my father died, and then the resentment. And that night, I went to a meeting and said, "My father just died, and here I'm at a meeting. You know, look at me." So I moved out of where I was living because it was a very sober environment, and I cared for the person that I was living with very much, and I did not want them to get any of the chaos that I was about to create on them at all. And I knew what I was doing subconsciously. I pushed anything and everybody away. And that thought started to come back to me. And the true insanity that we talk about in the second step, that thought started to come back to me. Maybe you were a kid going through a phase. Maybe this time it will be different. You've grown up now. You're a union elevator mechanic. You got a new car. You got a cell phone. You got credit cards. Maybe you can drink sociably now. Of course. And, of course, I started drinking, you know, because the decision was made. The insanity had me, you know. As sure as I'm sitting here telling you guys that I know I can't pick up a drink or a drug, and I know that to be true, when those thoughts were going through my mind, I absolutely 100% believed them, you know. And it took me about 6 months to get back into this fellowship. It was the longest relapse I'd ever had. When I got back in here and I had all this knowledge and I was trying to apply it, I sat with these old men that had known me for 10 years and I told them exactly what I was doing, my behavior and everything. And they looked at me and they shocked me. They said, "Kenny, Alcoholics Anonymous worked for you." I said, "What? I drank." They said, "Yeah. You also became employable. You know, you stayed sober for 5 years." And they rattled off these things and they looked me dead in the face and said, "You may have some problems other than alcohol." I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Isn't it bad enough I'm an alcoholic? Seriously, now I got problems other than alcoholism too? Really? And this one guy asked to be my sponsor. He directed me to a therapist. Every time I'd call him, he'd be like, "Have you called Donna? Have you called Donna?" And eventually, I knuckled in. And, you know, I started to see this therapist. And I was like, "You know what? We're not talking about this, 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 or this. We're only going to talk about one thing." And we talked about all of it. And she was a great lady, or she is a great lady, and she is very versed in the 12 steps. And as I'm going to meetings and doing this, I remember I was still was irritable, restless, and discontented. I was still, like, not happy. And I remember talking with this guy. I'm like, "You know, I got all this knowledge. I'm trying to apply it. It's not working. Why isn't it working? And I had 5 years before. Why isn't it working now?" And he said to me, he said, "We're sober today based upon our relationship with God, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, right." And he goes, "What makes you think you're guaranteed a relationship with God just because you got your ass back in these rooms?" And I wanted to give him the Jesus Sunday school answer because Jesus loves everybody, you know. But the reality was I knew quite a few people that had 5, 8, 15 years and went out and never got sober again, and that had tried to get sober and they could never get it again and OD and die. And I realized that, like, maybe I was taking this relationship with this power a little for granted. You know, Maybe the grace I'd been given, I was a little too like, yeah, I got this shit. God, yeah, of course God's working for me. He loves me, you know. Today I don't take it for granted. I had my last drink in August of 1995, God willing. And I'd love to tell you everything's been great ever since, you know. I'd love to tell you that, you know, I make all the right decisions. I don't. What I've done is I was able to find out what Jack was talking about. I remember me and Jack were talking, and he said, Kenny, the 12 steps were about three things. He said, in 1, 2, and 3, you make peace with God. 4, 5, and 6, you make peace with yourself. And 7, 8, and 9, you make peace with your fellows. Then, Kenny, in 10, 11, and 12, you learn how to live at peace. And the reality of it was, because my childhood was such a train wreck, because there was just some seriously fucked up shit that went down, I could not fully make peace with myself. That was the truth. And there was a, you know, I'd love to sit here and tell you guys that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous fixes every problem. It doesn't. You know, what I found was that Alcoholics Anonymous will get me out of the bottle and give me some clarity of thinking to act on my other problems and to find a solution. You know, the book talks about that God gave us fine doctors and practitioners of various kind, and that we should take advantage of them. They give freely of themselves. And I was hesitant to do that. You know, I was hesitant to do that because, you know what? My big ego wanted to say, I worked 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and I basically fixed myself. And none of that's fucking true. You know, I showed up here broken, shot out little kid that did not know how to grow up, that was pissed off at the world and God and everybody around him. And slowly over time, did this thing work for me and where I could make some peace. Now, I know that there's still a long way to go. And that's the beautiful thing about this program, is that I don't stop growing. I've had moments where I did. But I know that if I keep an open mind and I keep that willingness and I keep that understanding of I did not create this, I did not work the 12 steps and do this to myself, that this was grace and it was given to me, and the best thing I can do is get out of the way and let this power use me as it sees fit, I believe I'm going to keep it. You know, the best way I can do that, I wish I could sit here and tell you guys that I'm a spiritual giant and I can pray this thing away and I can meditate it away and I can read some books and be enlightened. But the best way I can do that is by coming to meetings, talking, not even working with, talking with other alcoholics. And I tend to get out of self, and this power tends to work through me. And this is a way of living that works in rough going and in good going, you know. That, you know, this program, this design for living just works. And, you know, it all comes back to me. You know, I got a new sponsor recently, and, you know, I went through some shit. And it's just some rough times, and I would call him up, and I'd start venting, and, you know, we'd start laughing. And I'd start laughing. He goes, well, at least you got a good attitude about it. I'd say, well, what other choice do I have? You know? Because I really don't. And I know it's going to be okay. You know, I am convinced today, and I've been through enough shit, I am convinced today that if I don't pick up a drink or a drug, I'll be okay. And when I first came into this program, that's all I ever wanted was to be okay. I didn't want to be dancing on dandelions. I didn't want to be grinning and like, oh, everything's wonderful. I just wanted to stop fucking hurting and stop fantasizing about killing myself, because that's kind of dreadful when you're 18. You know, I showed up here, I was 18 years old, I felt like I was 40. I'm 51, I feel like I'm closer to 18 now, you know. Yeah, it's a great way of life, as long as I can get out of the way and let this power use me as it sees fit. And with that, I'm sure I've bored you folks long enough, and I'm going to shut up. Thanks.